Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really tearing apart the invisible codes that structure your world.
That's right.
We're doing a deep dive into semiotics. That's the study of signs and meaning. And our goal, really, is to give you the tools, the concepts, to look at what you call reality and realize it's not just this fixed thing out there. It's actively built by the systems we use every single day.
Yeah, it's like an intellectual shortcut. In a way, semiotics, you know, at its core, it's about everything that can be taken as a sign.
Okay, so a sign is?
If you boil it down, it's just something which stands for something else. That's the classic definition. It's basically a substitution mechanism.
Something stands for something else.
Yeah.
That idea, I mean, it sounds simple, but it's actually pretty disruptive when you really start thinking about it.
It really is.
So to set the stage, we kind of have to tackle that original question, right? The philosophical one about how sign systems even work.
You mean the nature versus convention debate?
Exactly. Is the link between, say, a word, the sign, and the thing it refers to, is that link natural? Or is it just, you know, conventional, agreed upon?
Right. And that debate goes way back. Ancients, Plato, Aristotle.
Yeah.
But the modern understanding generally is that it's fundamentally conventional.
Conventional.
Yeah. Aristotle, he basically asserted there's no natural connection between the sounds of a language and the things they signify.
So the actual sound, diog, doesn't have anything inherently dog-like about it.
Not at all. It's arbitrary.
Which is why Shakespeare nailed it, didn't he?
Right.
That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet.
Perfect example.
The thing itself, the rose's essence, it stays the same, no matter what label, what sound we stick on it. The relationship's arbitrary.
Arbitrary, yes. But, and this is a really key clarification, while the specific sound or symbol is arbitrary, the meaning isn't just created in a vacuum by individuals.
Okay.
The meaning of any sign really hinges on its difference, its relationship with other signs within the same system.
Wait, hang on. So the meaning isn't actually in the word red itself. It only means something because it's not blue or green.
Precisely. Meaning is relational, differential. It's not inherent in the sign alone. And we see this kind of thing playing out all the time, especially, say, in political symbols.
Right, the political color example. That really highlights the conventionality, doesn't it?
It does.
Like in the U.S., you have red versus blue.
Mm-hmm.
That contrast is what gives the meaning, what invites interpretation.
But it wasn't always that way.
No. Before 2000, news outlets often used red for Democrats. Then, suddenly for the election maps, they flipped it. Blue became Democrats, red became Republicans.
And the fact that they could just swap them like that proves those links were never natural. They were always social conventions, interchangeable.
Okay, so that's step one. Realizing the sign system is conventional. Where does that take us next? What does that do to our perception of, well, reality?
Well, it leads you straight into the social constructionist viewpoint. If our symbols are purely conventional, then reality itself must be mediated by those signs.
Mediated? So
yeah.
It stops being this concrete thing out there.
It becomes more like a framework we construct using signs. Now, very few people argue there's absolutely no external reality. But the point is, we can only know it, only access it through our sign systems.
Which brings us to that famous idea.
Alfred Korzybski's principle.
Wow.
The map is not the territory. And similarly, the word is not the thing.
Right. The representation isn't the actual object. Like René Breakett's painting. The pipe.
Ceci n'est pas une pipe. Exactly.
This is not a pipe. And the painting isn't lying. It's a representation of a pipe. You can't pack tobacco in the canvas.
The sign and the thing it represents, the referent, they're not identical.
So this mediation, it's not just about representing things. It actually does something practical for us.
Absolutely. It performs a critical function. Categorization. Language makes experience orderly. Think about it. The world bombards us with this constant chaotic flow of sensory data.
Yeah, just stuff happening.
Right. Language organizes that chaos. It carves out discrete and stable objects from the flux. It creates concepts.
So if we didn't have the category chair, we wouldn't see chairs. We'd just see, I don't know, surfaces at a certain height.
Pretty much. Vaguely hard, horizontal surfaces, maybe. You couldn't think about the abstract concept of sitting in the same way. You need the category.
Makes sense.
And sociologist Eviatar Zerubbabel, he really emphasizes this. He argues categories aren't facts of nature. They're human constructs. Language imposes patterns, transforming that messy natural world into a manageable, shared social world.
So without categories?
Things would be quite literally unthinkable. You couldn't process the world.
Okay. So we know signs are conventional. They mediate reality, and they create categories. Now, how do we actually analyze the structure of those categories? How does our culture organize knowledge?
Right. For that, we turn to structural analysis. It focuses on contrasts, on differences, and the fundamental tool here, really pushed by Claude Levi-Strauss, is the binary opposition.
Binary opposition, like two opposing concepts.
Exactly. He argued that almost all structural relations in culture, in myth, in society, they boil down to these fundamental contrasts.
And you see them everywhere, right? Nature versus culture.
Raw versus cooked, male versus female, us versus them. They're like the engine of how we conceptualize things. We define one term partly by saying what it's not.
But are those oppositions always equal?
Rarely. And this is where it gets really interesting and, frankly, quite revealing about ideology. They're usually hierarchical, which brings in the concept of markedness.
Markedness. Okay, what's that? Developed by Roman Jakobson, right?
That's the one. It explains this hierarchy. Why is one side of the opposition often treated as the default, the norm?
How does that work?
Well, Jakobson said that in any opposition, you typically have an unmarked form and a marked form. The unmarked is the default, the primary term. The marked form is secondary, it's derivative, it needs qualification.
Like with verbs. The present tense is just the verb, but past tense needs an ed or something. It's marked.
Exactly. Present tense is usually unmarked. You only have to explicitly mark it for past or future.
So the crucial insight then is that this unmarked form, it reflects dominance, like representational dominance. It creates this sort of illusion of normalcy.
Precisely. The source material gives a classic sociological example. Think about categories like adult, white, heterosexual, male. In many Western cultural contexts, this combination often functions as the unmarked category.
The default human.
In a sense, yes. While other groups say youth, people of color, LGBTQ plus individuals, women are often treated implicitly as marked. They deviate from that assumed norm.
So the unmarked category gets treated as the universal standard. Like if you see a job ad for fireman, the default assumption is male.
Right. But if the ad said female firefighter, the term is explicitly marked because it deviates from the unspoken unmarked norm. It needs that extra descriptor.
And the result is the dominance of that unmarked term makes its own status, its own dependence on the marked term, kind of invisible. It lets one category seem like it represents everyone.
Yeah, it naturalizes a specific viewpoint. Now, this is structural analysis looking mostly at the literal meaning, the denotation.
Okay, denotation.
But if binary oppositions give us the structure, where does the deeper cultural meaning, the ideology, really come in? That takes us beyond the literal. It takes us into connotation.
Right. Denotation is the dictionary definition, more or less.
Right.
The broad consensus meaning.
What everyone generally agrees a sign points to.
But connotation, that's looser, more subtle, depends heavily on social context.
Exactly. Connotations are where we signal status, feelings, cultural values, often completely unconsciously. They're layered on top of the denotation.
In a culture like ours, driven by consumerism and status, pretty much everything carries connotations, doesn't it? Your clothes, your car.
Even your font choice.
Sure.
It all signals something.
The sources had a great example with design, showing how status and connotation get tangled up. In advertising, things like muted colors, lots of empty white space, smaller, delicate fonts.
Those tend to connote quality, refinement, maybe exclusivity, high status.
Right. And often associated, maybe stereotypically, with feminine qualities.
Sometimes, yes. And conversely, think about large gold fonts, lots of visual clutter, bright primary colors.
That often connotes what, cheapness, urgency, maybe bad taste or something aimed at kids.
It can, yeah. And those aesthetics often carry, again, stereotypically, more masculine connotations, loudness, boldness.
Wow. So even choosing a font size isn't neutral. It's doing ideological work through connotation.
Absolutely.
And if connotation is all about this subtle social signaling, doesn't that imply meaning often works through figurative language, not just literal description?
Definitely. Connotation relies heavily on metaphor, suggestion, association, comparison. We're always using rhetoric, even subconsciously, when we interpret these signs.
The codes are just everywhere.
Inescapable.
They really are. Speaking of inescapable codes, what happens when we try to communicate across the biggest cultural divide imaginable? Like, to other species.
The ultimate test case.
Let's talk about the Pioneer 10 plaque from 1972. Designed by scientists for scientifically educated aliens, supposedly, the idea was to convey information about who we are, where we are, when we launched it.
A message in a bottle thrown into the cosmic ocean. The intention was pure scientific communication. But the art historian Ernst Gombrich had a pretty devastating critique.
What did he say?
He basically argued that aliens could not possibly get the message. Why? Because they wouldn't have the social and representational codes that we used unconsciously to draw the plaque.
Ouch, that's humbling. We thought we were sending universal science, but we just sent a cultural snapshot from the early 70s.
Pretty much. A very specific, culturally loaded snapshot.
So where did the codes break down? Can we unpack the failures?
Yeah, we can look at it on maybe three levels. First, just the basic representational codes. The plaque shows the Pioneer probe's trajectory, right? Marked with a little directional arrowhead.
Sure, pointing the way. Seems obvious.
To us, Gombrich pointed out that the arrowhead is a purely conventional symbol. It likely originated from, well, actual bows and arrows. What if you encounter a species that never developed projectile weapons like that?
They wouldn't know it means direction. It might just look like a shape.
Exactly. We signaled direction using an ancient weapon symbol. Code failed.
Okay, that's one level. What else?
Second, the social codes. Think about the human figures on the plaque. The man is shown with his right hand raised.
The universal gesture of greeting.
Is it universal? It was intended as a friendly greeting in a specific cultural context. But an alien species. Without that code, that raised hand can mean, stop, go away, look at my hand, I curse you, anything.
Oh, okay. The message becomes totally ambiguous, lost in translation immediately.
Instantly. And then third, perhaps the most subtle but also pervasive failures. The gender codes.
Even on these stripped down scientific figures.
Oh, yeah. They still carried the cultural baggage of, as the source puts it, white, middle class American culture of the early 1970s. Look at the postures. The male figure is depicted as active. He's the one making the greeting gesture, initiating contact. The female figure is more passive, just standing there, almost posing like a model waiting to be observed.
So male activity, female passivity.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the supposedly objective scientific diagram.
Our ingrained ideological codes about gender roles were embedded right there, clear as day, even if unintentionally.
So this whole deep dive, it really shows that whether you're looking at a political map, an advertisement, or even a message aimed at aliens, all our experience is filtered through these sign systems.
Constantly. We can't escape them.
And semiotics, then, it gives us the tools to kind of denaturalize these codes, to see that what feels like basic common sense or just the way things are, is often a cultural construct, a very powerful, deeply ingrained one.
And those constructs, those meanings, are ultimately built using fundamental rhetorical tools, ways of making connections.
Right. So if we accept that even complex cultural codes, gender roles, visual status cues, political symbols are built on things like suggestion, analogy, comparison, it leads back to the very foundation of communication.
The building blocks of meaning.
The source material actually identifies four master tropes, four core rhetorical figures that arguably all others boils down to. Metaphor.
Making a comparison, X is like Y.
Metonymy.
Association, using something related to stand for the thing itself, like saying the crown for the monarchy.
Synecdoche.
Where a part stands for the whole, like all hands on deck.
And irony.
Saying the opposite of what you mean, often for effect.
Okay, so if those four, metaphor, metonymy, synecdoche, irony, are really the bedrock of all language, all communication.
Then we have to consider a pretty profound implication.
Which is?
Is even the most seemingly factual reality your experience? Is it ultimately just a matter of skillfully arranged rhetoric, a particular way of framing things using these tropes?
Wow. Think about that as you go about your day. The codes are invisible, operating constantly below the surface. But now maybe you can start to see them structuring every assumption you make.
So the question to leave you with is, what system, what set of codes are you unknowingly using right now just to interpret your immediate surroundings?